You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Trump administration introduced a new rule that could indefinitely detain migrant children and their families. We'll learn more how that would work in just a bit. Right now, it's time for our weekly review of Wisconsin news with reporters from around the state. First, Milwaukee Public Museum officials say that maintenance problems could put the facility at risk of losing an important accreditation from the American Association of Museums. Corey Hess is a WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. Corey, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rob.
What are some of the maintenance issues at the public museum there that could be causing this problem?
Well, there's a few. Two big issues is the aging air conditioning system in the museum, and there's also water leaking in the museum in a few different spots. The big problem is the roof, which is causing leakage from the fourth floor roof through the fourth floor, then into the third floor, which is where the exhibits are.
Now, this is kind of weird timing, right? Because everybody knows at the museum that they're looking for a new location. It's going to move eventually, but it's going to take a while, right?
It is going to take a while. The museum officials are saying that they have not chosen a site yet. So at best, they're not going to break ground until about 2022. And then, of course, they have to move everything from the museum. And before they can do any of that, they have to launch a huge fundraising campaign.
Do we have an idea of how much it would cost to do this maintenance at the current museum, knowing that it's going to be for a building they're not going to be in forever?
Well, these two projects really would cost about $1.6 million, which in the grand scheme of things with the county budget is not that much money. But like you just pointed out, they're not going to be staying in this building. And with finances the way they are at the county, I think nobody really wants to do anything.
So is there any process underway either to raise money or to get the, I guess, county board on board with paying for these repairs?
Well, this week, the museum made a plea to the county board committee as they're working through the budget process to try to get them to do something. The museum is owned by the county. The county owns the building and the artifacts.
So there's this accreditation process from the American Association of Museums. Is there a clock ticking? Is there a time they have to have things done by to not risk losing that accreditation?
That's another thing. So the air conditioning isn't only for the people's comfort, it's for the artifacts, and the collections have to be kept at a certain temperature. So in the summer, the museum's going to be reaccredited for its 10-year accreditation process. And if they can't keep these artifacts at the right temperature, they could lose that accreditation.
We'll keep watching that, Corey. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Corey Hess, WPR reporter based in Milwaukee. She talked with us about repairs needed at the city's public museum. Now, the Green Bay Redevelopment Authority passed a rule this week that would make public art a part of any new projects that get the city's help through tax incremental financing. Haley B. Miller is a reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette. Haley, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What is this new rule going to require from developers in Green Bay?
So any developer who wants to use TIF funding, TIF assistance from the city for development will need to put 1% of the project's overall cost into public art. And that can mean a statue, a mural. One example an alderman gave me was incorporating mosaic tiles into a patio. A range of different ways that they can bring more art to the community.
And an important point here, what this doesn't cover, if I'm a developer, a commercial developer, and I want to build something without this tax incremental financing from the city, this doesn't affect me at all, right?
Correct. Yep. It's only for developers who want that assistance from the city.
And what did you hear from city officials about why they think this is important to require this public art in these city-supported projects?
For them, the city public art is one arena where the city can improve, and they feel that increasing that will contribute to better civic engagement, better livability. There has been research that shows that public art can decrease crime in certain areas, so they really just feel it will bolster the community as a whole and make it more attractive for those who live here, those who are thinking about living here.
Have you heard any kind of pushback to this idea?
In general, everyone is very excited about the idea of more art and no one thinks that more public art is a bad idea by any means. I did talk to one developer, though, who expressed some concern about it being a blanket 1% for any project. He feels that the city should have considered a sliding scale of sorts, because when you get to a certain point, you know, if a project is $500 million, 1% of that does become quite a chunk of money. And his concern is that for some developers, that amount of money could sort of put a hole in that project's budget.
And Haley, do we know when this actually kicks into effect now, when a new project, again, receiving this TIF financing will be required to do this?
It's my understanding that it kicks in right away. I do not believe that it applies to projects who are, you know, currently in the works of developing an agreement with the city, but anything going forward will be subject to this.
Haley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Haley B. Miller is a reporter at the Green Bay Press-Gazette. She talked with us about a new rule requiring developers in Green Bay to set aside money for public art as a part of some projects in the city that get a type of tax support. Now we head to the shores of Lake Superior in Iron County, where the Saxon Harbor Marina is close to reopening 3 years after flood damage forced it to shut down. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
Well, good. Now, take us back a few years to July, I think it was, of 2016, and what happened at Saxon Harbor Marina?
Yeah, so if you remember that storm, it was pretty incredible. It caused more than $35 million in damage across northern Wisconsin. And for Saxon Harbor, they were pretty much the hardest hit as part of that storm, along with the Bad River Band of Lake Superior, the Lake Superior Tribe. Basically, at Saxon Harbor, they saw torrential downpours. I think they got a total of 10 inches of rain that was reported to the National Weather Service. And that just devastated that harbor and marina. The Oronto Creek became a rushing river that washed boats miles out into Lake Superior.
Talk about the economic impact of the marina. How important is it to that area?
Well, it's pretty important to Iron County. I mean, before the flood, around 2,000 visitors would come on a really busy weekend. And a June 2019 assessment showed that around $83 is spent each day in the community when people are visiting the area. So the revenues from camping and boating that happened at Saxon Harbor generated more than $100,000 each year for the county parks budget. And that's a pretty significant deal for a small county like Iron County.
So 3 years now, and it's just reopening. It sounds like a long time to rebuild a marina. I've never rebuilt one myself, though. Why is it taking this long?
Well, because the wheels of federal and state government move pretty slowly when it comes to emergency disaster funds. Basically, there are a lot of requirements that local governments have to meet when it comes to federal disaster funding, and that's passed through the state. And the work has to be 100% completed before they can get any reimbursement. And it just takes a long time to get those funds in place and to get the support in place for all of that work to happen. So, and also, if you remember last year, there was the Father's Day storm that northern Wisconsin saw, and that also caused some additional damage to the marina and harbor there, but they were able to keep on track as much as possible, and now they're going to be at least opening up the marina come Labor Day weekend.
Is it going to look different? Are there going to be changes to Marina 2.0?
Yes. Yeah, it is going to be a little bit different. Basically, they've made some changes to make it more flood resilient. They have a bridge there that's bigger and higher off the ground. They have some riprap lining the marina instead of a sand berm that was there before. There will be fewer spaces for boats because the trend is that people are buying bigger boats. So they put in an 81-slip boat marina instead of the 91-slip boat marina they had before. So it'll look pretty different, but people are saying right now that they like the changes that are there.
Before I let you go, Danny, riprap lining?
Oh, so a loose stone that forms a breakwater.
Okay,
so
I've seen that, sure.
Yeah, it kind of protects from the waves of Lake Superior.
And now I know what to call it. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about the Saxon Harbor Marina, which is close to reopening after closing due to flood damage back in 2016. She wraps up our weekly roundup of news from around the state. Coming up, the Trump administration announced new changes to a legal agreement that could impact families crossing the border. We'll learn more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, multiple fires are burning in the Amazon rainforest, a place that's been nicknamed the lungs of the planet. We'll find out why and what's driving a growing number of wildfires elsewhere in the world. First, the Trump administration announced this week it would make changes to a longstanding rule that dictated how long the federal government could detain children who cross the U.S. border with their families. The Flores Agreement has been on the books since 1997 and was last reinterpreted in 2015. Trump administration officials say that families take advantage of the rule and that smugglers are incentivized to claim children are members of their family to cross the border. Our next guest is here to talk about the Flores Agreement and how it fits into U.S. immigration policy. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Rob.
What's your reaction to this news that the Trump administration is trying to, in effect, rewrite the way the Flores Agreement is implemented?
Yeah, well, we can really see this as something rather predictable if we look back to last year, because we saw the Trump administration was already challenging the Flores Agreement. It even came before a federal district judge that said, no, the U.S. did need to comply. If some of the listeners think back to last year, they may also recall the separation of families policy approach that was something else in the same vein, trying to somehow deter migrants from seeking asylum or trying to irregularly enter the border along the southwest of the U.S. territory. That sort of resulted in such a major political backlash that the Trump administration ended the separation of families and started looking for alternative ways. And so we can kind of understand this new rule to completely eliminate the so-called Flores Agreement guidelines as an alternative way of getting at that, being able to detain families, including children, for potentially an indefinite amount of time.
Can you take us back and explain the origins of this Flores Agreement? Where did this come from?
Yeah, so this originates in a series of lawsuits from the mid-1980s when we also had a very large numbers of people coming from the Central American countries that were faced with high levels of violence. So many of these people, like today, seeking asylum. But in particular, a group of migrant children were at the center of these lawsuits. In fact, the lawsuit is named after one of them, Jenny Flores, who was a 15-year-old girl. And these children were subjected to really degrading treatment, for example, being handcuffed and strip searched, being kept in what we would call jail-like facilities with other unrelated adults that made them feel unsafe, poor access to doctors and health care, and even being denied visitation from relatives that they have in the United States. So the sort of long-term psychological, emotional, physical harm that came from this detention of these migrant children ultimately played out in the courts for over a decade. And like you said at the beginning of the show, in the late 1990s, 1997, was resolved between the INS, as we used to call our immigration authorities then, and the lawsuit plaintiffs, with a set of guidelines that from there on out were supposed to dictate how and under what conditions the U.S. detained migrant children.
What did that require then? What rules applied after the settlement?
So on one hand, we saw that the Flores settlement brought forward a lot of standards of how the children should be detained. So having adequate access to nutrition, recreation, health care, counseling services, hygiene items, those types of details. But I would say the bigger picture was really the U.S. government should not be detaining migrant children. The general sort of policy approach of the Flores Agreement was that detention should be avoided. And that's where you get this sort of 20-day limit that, you know, within 20 days, these children should be released to a suitable guardian or relative in the United States so that they don't have to be in any kind of detention. This really comes from a consensus within the medical community that any length of detention is psychologically, emotionally, and ultimately even physically harmful for children.
There was a revision to the settlement near the end of the Obama administration, I think in 2015. How did that come about?
Yeah, so it's often easy to forget in the partisan politics that we have in our environment today that even Obama as a Democratic president was really challenging a lot of these basic children's rights and human rights when it comes to immigration issues. So the Obama administration was trying to challenge Flores as well, trying to detain families for prolonged periods. And this is where we saw that the Obama administration received a rebuke from a federal judge for, you know, trying to really push the limits of Flores and even violating some of its basic principles. And so what the judge did was say, you know, you're trying to sort of evade, get around some of these standards and principles by saying, well, the children are not by themselves, they're with families, so then Flores guidelines don't apply. And the judge said, no, actually, this does extend to families. So the mothers with the children, you know, also should not be detained for more than 20 days.
Talking to Elise Cohen from the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, looking at an attempt by the Trump administration to challenge, to rewrite in some ways the regulations under a long-running settlement when it comes to the treatment of children coming into the country. And Elise, I want to talk about who this applies to. I didn't finish that sentence quite. Coming into the country illegally, coming into the country seeking asylum, does this apply to one group and not the other?
Oh, that's a great question. So it is for unauthorized, undocumented immigrants, what the Trump administration officials tend to call illegal immigrants or illegal aliens, even in the way they sort of frame the issue. So this would be for people that don't have documentation, don't have papers. But your point about, you know, what is the distinction? Where is the line between voluntary migrants who may be coming looking for a schooling or a better job or something like that and asylum seekers? That's an important point to focus on because many of these people are claiming or seeking asylum, meaning that they are leaving conditions in their home country that are violent, characterized by life-threatening conditions of persecution. So that's where this also starts to call in some undermining of international legal principles about how we treat asylum seekers. In particular, asylum seekers should not be detained for the purposes of deterrence. And that's something that can be very tricky for the administration because we've seen several officials and even the president himself get at the logic of why do we have these rule changes as preventing these unauthorized migrants from coming here in the first place. Well, if many of them are coming to seek asylum, then this is directly contravening that principle that you shouldn't try to deter asylum seekers, meaning you shouldn't try to prevent them from arriving in the territory to claim asylum.
Yeah, the Trump administration has argued, in effect, that people are gaming the system, taking advantage of the Flores settlement. It's incentivizing people to come to the country and even making the accusation that smugglers are encouraging people to bring children that they're parents of or not in order to take advantage of the settlement. Do we have evidence that that's the case?
Yeah, that's another really important point that you raise in terms of how this is being framed. So the supporters, like you said, will mention fraud. Trump, in particular, going back to last year, calls these guidelines and these standards for treatment of care and detention loopholes, right? So this is being framed as a way for what Republican senators will even say is like the children to be used as pawns by adults so that they can say, well, I have a child, so you can't detain me. We don't have much evidence of that. We know that the majority of these people, when they're interviewed by human rights groups, are indeed seeking asylum, and many of them, you know, are trying to get those credible fear screenings to claim asylum. But this idea of how it's framed, I think, fits into the political landscape because we can see, you know, for Republicans and especially Trump's base going into the 2020 elections, this is really a crucial strategy for electoral victory, is to fulfill his campaign promises that he is getting tough and cracking down on so-called loopholes within immigration. He also calls the notion of not detaining them, quote, catch and release, the idea that they would be caught for not having papers and then released as they await their immigration hearing date. So he calls it sort of catch and release. And again, for his supporters, that is something viewed very positively. Like, well, yeah, he's fulfilling his promises and he's just getting tough and preventing fraud.
On the legal side of things, this is a Trump administration rewrite of the enforcement of this settlement. Can they do that? Is this something that's going to be challenged in courts?
Oh, yeah. I think it will absolutely be facing a lot of legal battles. To start with, it would probably go to the same federal district judge that has already blocked other attempts to kind of wiggle out of the Flores standards. And we know the governor of California, a Democratic governor, has announced that he's going to file a lawsuit probably in conjunction with some other, Democratic-controlled states to try and block this. We're probably going to see some civil rights and civil liberties groups and migrant right groups try and block this. And there are a lot of legal grounds that deterrence point that I mentioned before, where you could say we have so much rhetoric from the officials making it clear that part of the logic, at least, is to deter, prevent these arrivals at the border, and that does violate international law, as well as some of our own domestic legal precedents. Number two, the notion that it could ever be in the child's health or interest to detain them for a prolonged time. There's so much evidence from the medical community that they could use in the legal battle. And then also, something else a bit tricky is that they would not have to have a state-licensed facility to hold the children and families. They would do their own self-licensing. So that's another one where you might see judges, push back and find that this is completely violating the basic principles.
What are you going to be watching for as a next step on this, Elise, in our last few moments?
Yeah, I think that already the administration knows it will be caught up in the courts, so probably won't go into effect in October as it would without legal challenges. So I'm really going to be watching more for how this plays out in the political debates and how this is used against Democratic presidential candidates who are forced to argue against it and then can be labeled as supporting open borders. So I'm really going to be watching how that rhetorical fight kind of unfolds in the coming weeks.
Elise, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Green Bay. She joined us today to talk about the Flores settlement on the detention of child immigrants and how the Trump administration is looking to change it. Coming up, we'll talk about the significance of the Amazon rainforest as multiple fires there continue to burn. Then we'll take a look at wildfires cropping up around the world, sometimes in unexpected places. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, the state's new director of children's mental health joins the show for a look at the challenges facing kids in the state and what it would take to provide the help they need. That's Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show. First, there are multiple fires burning in the Amazon rainforest right now, and Brazil's state space agency says there have been more than 74,000 fires there this year alone. The Amazon is nicknamed the lungs of the planet because it produces a big chunk of the world's oxygen, and there are concerns about how the fires can affect climate change. Ruth DeFries is an ecologist with Columbia University. Ruth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, people are sharing dramatic images of these fires in the Amazon right now. Can you put it into context for us? How bad are they this month?
Well, it is dramatic what we are seeing in the Amazon. There are fires that are occurring, and we can see those fires from space, from satellite data. These fires, it's important and different than what we think about in our own American West, that these fires are caused by humans. In the American West, the fires that we've been having are because many human-caused reasons, but also those are fire systems. So fire is a natural process in those systems. In the humid tropical forest, like the Amazon, those fires are not natural. There's some human intent behind it, and that intent is most likely a clearing of land to make way for agriculture.
This kind of land clearing for agriculture has been going on for some time. Is it speeding up? Is it getting worse now?
Well, it has been going on for some time. And if we look back to the early 2000s, there was a peak of deforestation and fires, even higher than what we're seeing now. The fabulous success story of Brazil is after that peak, the Brazilian government, both at the federal, state levels, environmental groups, companies looking at their supply chains, all came together and put in place very effective policies to reduce that deforestation. So there was a peak 15 or so years ago, and that dramatically declined. And that was an example to the world that it is possible to put in place policies to get deforestation under control while becoming an economic leader. Brazil is an agricultural powerhouse. What we're seeing now is a reversal, an uptick in the deforestation and fires that are related to them.
Can you talk about the kind of vicious circle this can create? People intentionally deforest and burn things down, and I understand that may make those lands then more vulnerable to future fires?
Yes, that's absolutely right. There are many different impacts of the fires. One is on local air quality, and we know about that in this country, that the smoke from the fires travels in the atmosphere to population centers, and people end up breathing that unhealthy, hazardous smoke. That's one impact. Another impact is on our global climate. So the Amazon forest is a bank of carbon that absorbs and stores the carbon dioxide that we emit into the atmosphere. So as we lose that carbon store, the carbon enters into the atmosphere and contributes to global warming as a greenhouse gas. In addition, as you mentioned about the drying, the Amazon forest or forests in general are great circulators of water. They pull up water from the depths and circulate it and generate rainfall. So to the extent that we lose the forest, we are creating conditions where it can be a vicious cycle, where it becomes drier, and then the less forest there are, the drier it is, the more the longer fires burn, and the longer they can burn out of control and reach adjacent areas, and that is that kind of vicious cycle.
Talking to Ruth DeFries, ecologist at Columbia University, looking at the fires in the Amazon rainforest. Ruth, you mentioned that peak 15 years ago, then things got better until now. What did we see when it came to recovery? Does the rainforest recover in those border areas where there's been burning?
Well, it could if the burning is not too severe, if the system doesn't change. There's many scientific studies about the forest system along that fringe of the Amazon becoming more savanna-like with lots and lots of burning. So if it tips over into that kind of system, then it would be difficult to see a recovery. But the Amazon has been used for a long, long, long time. It's, we think it's pristine, but it isn't really. It's been used by lots of different people, and our ecosystems are marvelously resilient if we allow them to be.
Speaking of ecosystems, can you talk about the species diversity that is at risk when we lose lots of Amazon rainforest?
Yeah, so tropical rainforest, the Amazon being the largest in the world, are homes to many, many, many different kinds of species, insects, reptiles, mammals, plants, many different kinds of species, and most of those species are not even yet identified. So when we lose the habitat for those species, we don't even know what we're losing by the time that they've been lost. We don't know what we're losing in terms of their value for medicinal purposes and also just for the value of life on this planet.
Are you worried that this is a new trend that we're seeing backsliding now against that progress you had talked about for the last decade or so?
Well, I think what is very concerning about what's going on now in Brazil is the refuting evidence and science and what the Brazilian scientists themselves are saying. So Brazil has a very well-established, well-regarded, long-term, decades, very good system for monitoring their deforestation, and that's come under question. The integrity of that system has come under question, and that's, you know, if we don't have a way to see what's going on, then it's difficult to put in place policies to control it.
What are you watching for now as these fires go on and in the years to come when it comes to the potential for losing even more vast tracts of rainforest?
Well, we have satellite data. We have good ways to observe what's going on, and there will be many scientists who will be looking at the trends in the fires and the area that's deforested. So we do have ways to track that.
What would you say to people who feel like, you know, this is a distant story on another continent, not really that relevant for people here in the United States?
Well, the extent to which the loss of the forest affects the global climate, then it really does affect all of us as our actions and our use of fossil fuels and all the ways that we contribute to climate change contribute to climate change that everyone is feeling in other parts of the world. So it's a global issue. So every single person on this planet is part of it.
And you mentioned earlier that it took an effort, international governments, Brazil itself, companies putting pressure on to stop that last wave of deforestation. Are you hoping to see that kind of response again?
Well, I can't say how the politics go. We know the winds of politics can change quickly. But what we do know from what happened in the last decade was that it is possible. That it is feasible to put in place these policies, and with investment in agricultural management and improving yields, that those policies that reduce deforestation do not need to infringe on economic development. So the common notion that it's a either or, I think what we saw in the last decade was that that does not have to be the case.
Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Ruth DeVries, ecologist with Columbia University. She was with us today to talk about the fires burning in the Amazon rainforest in Brazil and what the fires could mean for climate change. We're going to keep talking about wildfires in the Amazon and elsewhere around the world. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the fires in the Amazon? Do you worry that the world isn't paying enough attention? Do you have questions about how fires are impacting climate change and carbon in the atmosphere? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the impact of wildfires on climate change in the Amazon and wildfires around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following this story, the fires in the Amazon? Does this have you worried? What do you want to see happen in response? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Umar Irfan covers climate change, energy, and the environment for Vox. He's also a contributor to Science Friday. His latest article is titled, Wildfires Are Burning Around the World. The Most Alarming is in the Amazon Rainforest. Umar, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we move on to look at the rest of the world, we were just talking about the Amazon rainforest. Talk about the importance of this one in particular before we move on to other wildfires.
Sure. The Amazon, as a giant forest, is a huge reservoir of carbon. And as your last guest explained, this, when it burns, it has global consequences. And that's why it's so alarming. And also, this is a rainforest, which gets moisture much of the year, even in the dry season. And so it's not really something that burns without human intervention. And that's why this is so alarming.
Now, that's the one that's getting a lot of attention now. You wrote in a couple of recent pieces looking at fires going on around the world. Can you take us to some of those places where we're seeing a big, maybe bigger than usual fires?
Yeah, that's right. We've seen fires recently spark in Turkey, in Greece, in the Canary Islands off the coast of Spain, and even in Siberia and in Alaska. Now, it's important to remember that unlike the Amazon, wildfires are a common part of the natural ecosystem in many forests around the world, including the ones we just mentioned here. But what's unusual is the scale and the timing of them this year. The wildfire season in Alaska usually does not go this long. And in Siberia, where we've seen a fire in what's the world's largest forest, it's approaching a record area burned right now.
Do we know why in places like Alaska and Siberia we're seeing these larger, more extensive, and longer than usual fires?
Well, one of the underlying changes that we are seeing is, of course, the climate is warming. We just came out of the hottest July on record. And that, remember, is a global average, not just the northern hemisphere where it's summer right now. So a consequence of all that heat is that a lot of these forests tend to dry out. Now, looking in various regions, there have been some studies looking at western forests in the United States, for example, that have found that a significant portion of the drying in the forest is due to human-caused warming. And that's one of the factors. Another factor is that humans are interacting more and more with forests. As populations grow, people are moving into what's called the wildland-urban interface, and that increases the likelihood of an errant spark or a downed power line or even arson deliberately starting these giant fires.
So climate change in and of itself doesn't start a wildfire, but it sounds like climate change is making them more likely and bigger.
That's correct, yes. But it is fair to say that humans in general are contributing to the scale and destruction from these fires.
Is there a worry about a cycle, as we talked about a little bit with our last guest, but a different cycle that, okay, climate change is making these wildfires more likely, but the impact of the wildfires is making climate change happen faster?
Yes. I mean, forests are an important reservoir of carbon. They take in a lot of carbon dioxide on a regular basis. Now, as I mentioned earlier, yes, there is a natural burning cycle in many of these forests, but because these fires are burning so much hotter and so much bigger, that cycle is being thrown off balance, that we're seeing longer periods of time of recovery for the forest, but that we're also seeing, you know, massive back-to-back fire seasons. You know, California, which we've seen in recent years, has seen, you know, record fire seasons back-to-back in 2018. I mean, the largest fire happened, and then before that, the largest fire was just earlier that year. So these massive blazes happening in such a short, compressed time frame is kind of unusual and is pretty alarming if we're trying to limit, you know, human-caused warming in the next few decades.
Umair Irfan is with us from Vox. He covers climate change, energy, and the environment there. We're talking about wildfires, dramatic pictures coming out of the Amazon rainforest, a renewal of big wildfires there, most of which have a human cause, but also a lot of places around the world. Let's dig into some of the ones you mentioned. Places like Turkey and Greece, I'll admit, Umair, I don't think of as heavily forested or wildfire prone. Can you talk about those fires in particular?
Sure. There are fires that do occur in those areas. I mean, last year, Greece had some pretty deadly fires that started spreading, and they believe that those were caused by arson. But in the Mediterranean region, I mean, yes, it tends to get very hot, but it also, this year, it's been also pretty dry. And so the normal cool moisture that comes off the coast hasn't really been moving inland, and a lot of those forested areas and vegetation has been drying out. And again, these are areas that are also increasingly becoming more densely populated. And so as the populations increase and people encroach on these wildlands or move building closer and closer to forests, the likelihood of an ignition event just keeps going up.
Another damage from these wildfires is that people in populated areas, places like Sao Paulo, say that are feeling the smoke coming from these fires, their quality of life, their air quality is being affected pretty heavily. What do we see there?
Right. I mean, we've seen some images on social media of people posting, you know, water that's accumulated from their roofs that's turned black. They saw the sky turn gray in the middle of the day on Monday. And it's the ash and the smoke from these fires is definitely reaching the coastal areas, and we can see that through satellite images. The air quality is actually one of the most significant impacts of wildfires. When you have millions of people breathing in dirty air, that can cause a spike in emergency room visits in the near term, but over the long term, it can take years off of people's lives. And that's an effect that we won't see fully until, you know, the dust settles on this one and we look at the health data a few months from now.
Now, the Amazon fires in particular are turning into an international political issue with criticism of policies in Brazil coming from world leaders. What are you seeing there?
French President Emmanuel Macron, you know, basically tweeted out that he said that this is an international emergency, that this is a catastrophe. And his government is basically laying the blame on the government of Brazil for allowing these fires to happen. He says that now he's going to bring it up or put it on the agenda for the international G7 summit that's happening in France this weekend. The President of Brazil, meanwhile, basically told the President of France on Twitter to butt out of this, that this is not an issue that concerns him, and that, you know, this is something that is an internal matter for Brazil. So it is becoming an international issue. I mean, other countries are taking notice and they want action from the Brazilian government to combat these fires.
And in Brazil, we've had a change of government recently and a change of policy when it comes to development on of the rainforest and removal of parts of the rainforest. What has been the impact there?
Right. We saw since last year an 84% increase in the number of wildfires and a more than 80% increase in the amount of deforestation. And that, I think, can be attributed to the political change. The government of Jair Bolsonaro has, if not overtly, has covertly or tacitly given approval to exploitation of the forest. He's openly talked about, you know, being a nickname that he's picked for himself as Captain Chainsaw. He talks about, you know, clearing land for mining, for oil extraction, for farming, and also for the timber industry. He thinks that this is a major monetary asset that he wants to exploit for the benefit of the Brazilian economy.
And this can be difficult for so-called first world countries to bring up, because a lot of times a developing country will say, well, hold on, we're just doing what you all were doing 100, 200 years ago.
That's right. I mean, this is Bolsonaro himself has said that France's interest in the rainforest is neocolonialism, that, you know, this is not anything of your concern, and that, you know, these developed countries have exploited their natural resources for a long time. But the Amazon is kind of unique. It is so vast in its scale that a lot of countries say that this is a global asset, both developing and developed countries, that they want some sort of mechanism to help keep these forests intact. And there are some programs that are in place internationally that will help, you know, take money from developed countries and pay people with forested regions to help preserve them or to help restore forests. And that's going to come up later in September when the United Nations gets together and they're going to be asking countries to ramp up their ambitions on fighting climate change, and helping people preserve forests is one of the key tactics that's likely going to come up.
Are there other parts of the world that you're watching, Omer, that might not be having wildfires right now, but they might be the next step in this story?
I mean, it's still important to pay attention to California. I mean, they've had a slower than average fire season this year, but it's still been pretty warm and dry in California, and the fire season still picks up in the southern part of the state in the fall. That's when the coastal winds start picking up. And so that concern now, I mean, there still could potentially be a major fire season there, where they're not out of the woods just yet.
And you mentioned maybe renewed international efforts looking at the Amazon fire and deforestation issue. Do you see fires, wildfires in general, being taken up as an international issue that countries are going to talk to each other about in general?
I mean, they're impossible to ignore. I mean, even within Brazil now, there are major protests going on, and so that government has to answer to it. And yeah, now it's an international issue. Now it's coming up in major meetings, and they're going to have to come up with a way to deal with this. Now, the wildfires, of course, are not exclusively the result of climate change, and there are other factors at play here as well, but it is something that is going to put, you know, climate change front and center, that, like, you know, this is something that we do expect more of as average temperatures rise, as weather becomes more extreme, and as we deforest areas, that it's going to further drive the cycle.
Umair, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
That's Umair Irfan, a writer who covers climate change, energy, and the environment at Vox. He's also a contributor to Science Friday. You may have heard him there. He was with us today to talk about what's causing wildfires burning around the world right now and the links they have to climate change. Coming up on Monday here on Central Time, a new project at the New York Times tracks the origins of slavery here in the United States and the lasting impact it's had on the country. We'll talk to one of the contributors to that project who says, now, in 2019, we're not doing a great job of teaching the history of slavery. A new Wisconsin effort aims to create a coordinated response to homelessness around the state. We'll find out what's in the works and take a look at the scope of the problem. Plus, we'll find out why the species of banana that we find on our grocery store shelves, it's mostly just that one kind, it's facing serious threats. A disease, a fungus spreading around the world, has arrived now in South America, Central America. It is threatening the banana supply. We'll find out why that is and if there's an effort to replace it, maybe with another kind of banana. That and look at some of the top news of the day coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 6, John talks to a guest from the Wisconsin Innocence Project about the long-term effort to get new trials for people wrongfully convicted of crimes. That's Monday at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then on this week's edition of Food Friday, we're talking about salads, how to jazz them up and make a whole meal out of salad for even the hungriest crowd. You can find recipes over at wpr.org/foodfriday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.